The Montrealer has been called a Canadian rock legend. He was a founding member of the platinum-selling band Mahogany Rush, walked away from his record company Columbia, continued to perform solo. He was sidelined for a while with a shoulder injury, but he came back and had some other problems. He just told me he's retired, but he will only play special events that mean something to him. And so that means he said yes to Italfest, which is coming up this week, and Montrealers will be able to catch him in a free concert this Friday. And right now he joins me in studio. Hi.
Hi, nice to see you.
What I really loved was watching your face when you were listening to that song. Tell me what goes through your mind when you hear that.
It's like I'm doing an overdub.
You mean you're playing along to yourself?
Yeah, like, yeah. I've got the headphones on and it brings back memories of, oh, maybe I should do this.
Yeah.
Maybe I should add this. Maybe I should take that away.
Really? You would improve upon that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is it always like that when you listen to yourself?
It takes two people to make a piece of art. It takes the artist and someone to tell him when to stop.
Okay. But you haven't stopped?
No.
No. Uh-huh. No. So I... It's so funny because you were sitting in here and I said, okay, you know, can I just want to check this fact and that, check this fact. And you said, nope, that's not right. Nope, that's not right. And it seems like a lot of the stories about you are not right. So let's just let you describe. So first of all, how would you describe your style? I know how other people have described it.
My style?
Mm-hmm.
It's an amalgamation of about 10 or 20 different things from the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That includes rock players like Jimi Hendrix and Johnny Winter, Quicksilver Messenger Service, the Allman Brothers, Santana, and then some jazz like George Benson, Ray Charles, the Beatles, the Doors. It's an amalgamation of all of that.
And tell me about like how you developed it, because you started playing fairly young.
I developed it by listening to all of that.
Yeah.
And I got sick at 13 by doing something that kids did in those days that they don't do anymore. Well, maybe they do.
And I think they do everything still.
I ended up in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little drummer. And they had no drums in the hospital, but they did have a guitar. So I picked up that guitar every day and played it and played it and played it and played it and played the music that I had been listening to for years.
Uh-huh.
And when I came out of the hospital, I was a guitarist.
Just played, like you just figured it out?
Figured it out.
From listening.
Yeah.
Can we just go back to that little thing that put you into hospital? Because, I mean, it's written widely about you that you had an overdose of LSD. Is that
true? That's correct. Very much so.
And then, and that, I guess, was kind of a life-changing experience in a lot of ways, right?
In many ways.
Tell me about that. Not just musically.
Well, since that experience, I haven't had an aspirin. And I'm going to be 72.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah. No drink, no drugs, nothing. I mean, I've been straight as an arrow.
Yeah.
Scared straight.
Scared straight.
And it was a very, very hard experience, and it lasted a long time. It didn't just last the time that, you know, the trip usually lasts. It lasted many, many years.
What was the hard experience? Being an addict, you mean? Or
no, being on that trip. It was the psychedelic dream, and it wasn't nice. You know, it's a lot of people make it out like, woo, woo, we're having a great time.
Yeah.
It's really nice. No, it wasn't nice. It was a very, very bad nightmare for a while. Now, prior to having blown my mind like that, it had been very, very nice.
Uh-huh.
So it was a big surprise when that happened.
Uh-huh.
And I was just a kid. I was just 13 years old. And so I ended up coming out of the hospital, and I was 14 years old. And couldn't go to Woodstock because of it. That was been in 69. And ended up playing guitar and finding other people who wanted to play with me. And all I wanted to do was express that world, that feeling, and find guys who would do it with me. And so it was. I called it Mahogany Rush. It wasn't a band name. It was an expression of what I was feeling, what I was going through. A weird way to express it, but it made sense at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, guys started to play with me. Guys started to watch me playing, and some people thought that they could take this kid and put him on a record and make money. And so they approached me, and at first I said no, because they were the establishment.
Mm-hmm, man.
They were the man. And then they said, well, we'll give you equipment. And I said, equipment?
Guitars are expensive also.
Yeah. Put you in this place called the studio, and we will never come in, and you could do whatever you want. Whatever I want, whatever you want. I can produce myself, you can produce yourself. So they wrote that all down on paper, and I did a first album. I was 16 years old.
That's crazy.
And then they sold my contract to 20th Century Fox, and I had the same rights to be my own producer on 20th Century Fox, which is a much bigger thing in Los Angeles. And I produced two more albums for them. And then they sold my contract to Columbia, and I produced seven albums for them. And after that seventh album with Columbia, which was not a great experience being over at Columbia, I finally said, no, I'm not doing any more albums for anybody except myself. And I left Columbia, and I had a lot of offers to go to other companies because we were playing very big buildings and we were selling a lot of records.
Mm-hmm.
And I said no, and everyone got mad at me and left.
You mean the band?
Yeah, the band, the crew. Look, I basically sabotaged what was a good thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, but not for you, obviously.
No, I was having a horrible time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like you have been driven by your own creativity, but also, you know, this expression of your feelings from the beginning. So it seems to me that that was just consistent with that.
Right. And so I set up a situation where I could just do what I wanted when I wanted. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing an album every 7 months or every year, I did it every 3 years, mm-hmm. every 4 years when I felt I had something to say. And I played, I still went out and played, but I didn't play all the big buildings anymore, mm-hmm. because I wasn't part of that scene, you know.
And do you regret that? Did you miss it at all?
Oh gosh, no.
No, I mean, because no. So many people dream of being like, that's the cliche, right? What do you dream of being? A rock star.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
I played Cal Jam 2 to 330,000 people. And I played regularly to 60,000 and 50,000 and 60,000, stadium after stadium after stadium. It became a blur.
Yeah.
It became, and I felt that it was affecting my artistic part because I was having to be like the other bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other bands were these rock bands and rock and roll bands, and I was going out and doing Johnny B. Goode and King B. and stuff that wasn't really my artistic side.
No.
But I had to do it to be on these festivals. I had to do that side of me. It is a side of me.
Yeah.
But it's one side of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do some of the more psychedelic sides of me in some of those instances. But when I finally started doing my own shows and not just the festivals, I was able to branch out. I started doing 3-hour shows and 4-hour shows. I got that from Bruce Springsteen.
I've been to a Bruce Springsteen show. He showed up late and it went on forever. Went on for a long time. Okay, so I'm not sure how to phrase this question properly, but you talking about psychedelics and you're in that, you know, big episode that happened when you were 13, but you said that you like that psychedelic side and yet you weren't taking psychedelics. So like, what is it like to play psychedelic rock without psychedelics?
Well, I never came down.
Right.
That's true.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It took me a lot of years to be able to cope with the world the way it is,
mm-hmm.
and still be, for lack of a better word, high.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go away. Once you cross a certain threshold, it doesn't go away. And you panic for a long time about that, and you're trying to get back to normal.
Right.
But then you realize that's normal.
Yeah.
And that's going to be your life. Huh. And you got to just ignore it and go on with your life. It's like if I take you, you've heard the expression, you can't unsee something.
Yes.
So it's that type of thing.
Right.
You can't unhear.
You've been there.
You can't unsee.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't unfeel.
The rush.
Yeah.
The mahogany
and
rush.
And so it stays with you, yeah.
Okay. Wow. It's still with you now?
Oh, absolutely.
I was going to say, can you describe it? But I guess that's what your music does.
That's the best way to describe it. There are ways to describe it using language, and I can write books on it.
Uh-huh.
But the best way to describe it is through feelings.
Uh-huh.
Because it, you know, I've tried to describe it in language on songs, and to me it fell flat. It never really, it's like the album covers that I would sit with artists and tell them, okay, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then they would draw moons, and they would draw gargoyles, and they would draw things like that.
Yeah.
They thought I was talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, of course. And the classic trippy,
yeah,
trippy visions.
So they were cartoon versions of the reality,
mm,
but they weren't the actual reality. And people who are hearing me, who have been through it, who have seen it and can't unsee it, they'll know what I mean.
So you play not to, like, capture it, but to kind of let it out?
Yeah, I play to paint it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, that's a good visual.
It's a way, you know, if an artist sits with an easel and paints, he doesn't do that so that he can have applause or that people can say he's a great artist. He just does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end, he may get applause and people may say he's a great artist, but that isn't his motivation. I'm a very, I'm an anti-hero. I don't like fame. I don't like fortune. I shy away from applause. I'm an anti-hero.
Unfortunately, I'm on a clock because I could keep this conversation going forever. But can you tell us what we can expect at the show on Friday?
I wish I could.
You'll just feel it when you get there?
We're going to get
so
up there.
Inconsistent.
I haven't seen my band in 16 years.
Oh.
So we're going to basically meet up, talk about what we've done, get on stage, and it should all come back to normal because we're pros.
Frank, wonderful meeting you and talking to you about this. Thank you so much. We'll be right back.
of course, Mr. Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush. Just a change from Tales of the Unexpected. Great album. Half live. Yeah. Just a change. Strange Dreams in there as well. That came out in 83 from Juggernaut. It was a bit of a hit single for him, at least in North America. Yeah, appropriate given the content of the interview. I don't know the name of the gal he was talking to. But it was, I mean, it was your fairly typical commercial radio interview. CJAD in Montreal, I believe. My interviews are much more in-depth and a bit more candid because I have the time and I usually, you know, there's no breaks or anything. So I would have pushed on the trip thing, you know, at 13, overdosing at 13 and then you know, having lasting effects. Interesting conversation, and obviously an interesting fellow is Frank, and I think he definitely should get on the Rick Beato show. That's the kind of interview that Frank would, I think, excel at, to expand on his mind expansion, shall we say. Strange Dreams in there as well. You heard the Dragonfly as well, the studio version from Mahogany Rush 4. It came out in 1976. And so I hope you enjoyed that. And I kind of pirated it off of the internet. And I think that interview went out on like Tuesday or Wednesday or something like that. He is playing in Montreal tonight at Ital Fest. And I contemplated getting a flight out there, but I looked at the cost and it was just ridiculous. It was like $600-$700 one way. To get there, and then I would immediately fly back. But I've got other things going on tomorrow morning that would interfere. Prior commitments, shall we say. And so we'll be doing the Terry Fox ride in Vancouver tomorrow. And you might see me on TV. Apparently City TV are going to be there, so that'll be an early morning for them as well. You are listening to Transatlantic Express Radio Show on the houseofprog.com and on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver. We're going to continue with more of that Coliseum stuff. Coliseum 2, of course, Gary Moore on guitar, John Heisman on drums, Don Airey on keyboards, and John Mole on bass. This is a track also from War Dance, and it is, let's see, what have we got? Oh, put it that way. Put it this way, put it that way, put it this way. You are listening to Transatlantic Express.